The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. This week, part one of my conversation with Professor John Pfaff. Dr. John Pfaff is a professor of law at Fordham Law School, and he is the author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. Let's get to it. Give me a summary. What's your book about? Tell us about your book, sir.
Yeah. So I mean, the main argument I'm trying to make is that this conventional wisdom we have, the things it points to matter, they're not irrelevant. But there's other things that matter more. And importantly, by focusing on things we do focus on, we tend to miss the things that matter more. And it arguably make it even harder sometimes to address the things that matter more. And so, you know, drugs is a great example of that. You know, personally, I think, you know, prison is a terrible way to handle drugs. I think most public health people think that prison is a terrible place to manage drug addiction. Even drug courts are tricky and problematic. And the more we can move into a public health view of drugs, the better. But the catch is that, you know, in the state prison system, and the states hold about 90% of all prisoners, they do most of the work, only about 15%, 1-5, not 5-0, of the people in prison are in prison for drugs, at most. It's probably, in reality, it's probably even less than that, because we classify people in prison by the most serious charge for which they were convicted. And so if someone is arrested for, say, you know, aggravated assault as part of a domestic abuse situation, and he has cocaine on him at the time of the arrest, perhaps the abused partner won't testify. It's a murky situation. And so the DA will agree to a deal. If you plead guilty to the cocaine, we'll drop the aggravated assault. He agrees, but the DA says, but we're going to demand prison time for the cocaine because of that assault. Right, that person shows up in our data as a nonviolent drug offender because from a prison point of view, the aggravated assault played no role. And so he's really there for violence, but shows up in our data as there for drugs. Right, and so our 15% include the true drug cases and these sort of pretextual drug cases. We can't break it apart. And, you know, about 55% of all people are in prison for violence. And of the long-serving inmates, those in the top 10% of the time served in a given state prison, almost all of them, well over 95% of them, are in for either murder, manslaughter, rape, or robbery. Probably as you spend more and more time, it becomes more than half of those who are in for a really long time are in for homicide. And so on the one hand, the 200 and some, the like 190,000 people who are in prison for drugs, you know, even if you're not an abolitionist, a large number of them should not be in prison. And so pushing back against incarceration as a way to respond to drug issues is good policy. But we have to do that in a way that doesn't preclude our ability to later take on the issue of violence. And we tend to do that. Right? Just before my book came out, right, when my editors would not let me change it and throw off all their page work and all the editing they'd done, so it's not in there, Vox came out with this survey of about 3,000 people nationwide asking them questions about criminal justice reform. And there are two questions that are very closely linked and very problematic. One question was, do you think a majority of people are about, or roughly a majority of people are in prison for drugs? And the survey broke things out by liberal, moderate, and conservative. And a majority of all three groups said yes, that about half of all people are there for drugs. But it's not 50%, it's 15%, right? It's completely wrong. That's bad. But the next question is what makes that question answer so problematic? The next question, well, one of the next questions was, are you in favor of reducing the time spent in prison by those convicted of violence who pose little to no risk of reoffending? And for there, a majority of all three groups, from 55% of liberals to 65% of conservatives, said no, that they are not in favor of changing how we punish violence. Right? And so the problem I think we've done is that we've put drug cases so much at the center of our discussion of prisons that we think we can get out of prisons, we can decarcerate in a meaningful kind of way just by focusing on the easy drug cases, and it means we remain unwilling to go after the harder violence cases. That oftentimes we phrase it as a trade-off, right? We're going to cut back on drugs in order to focus on violence and save prison beds for people who commit crimes of violence. That we, in fact, sometimes will actually, in the legislative process, you see this trade-off where the compromise is you cut the drug sentences in exchange for ratcheting up the sentences for violent crimes, right? And so the point I'm trying to make isn't so much that drugs are irrelevant. There are 200,000 people in state prisons, another 90,000 in federal prisons for drugs. That's 300,000 people, most of whom probably pose no safety risk in any meaningful kind of way, or to the extent they do pose a safety risk, something much more public health, housing, food-centered would be a far more effective and humane way of addressing that. But we've framed the debate in such a way that we make it really hard to ask these much more unavoidable, intractable problems about violence.
Indeed. In the drug policy reform, I know that we got much better over the last few decades, but back in the 80s and into the 90s, marijuana legalizers, like myself, talked about how this would allow authorities to focus on harder drugs. And that was stupid. I mean, that was just stupid. It was wrong. And we've learned since then, and we've changed that to, but then again, we've also, as you were saying, we talk about the need then to focus on more serious crime and violent crimes. And that leads to another problem, which, of course, we have a lot of, the Innocence Project and a lot of the state groups have shown there are a lot of people who are in for crimes they didn't actually commit. And then you've got the clearance numbers in general. Even with that, we only get about 50% of the violent crimes cleared each year. Of course, those. Well, I want to ask you about I want to ask you about the numbers before we go into some of the other stuff. I've always believed you need to have good data if you're going to formulate good policies. You may not formulate good policies even if you have the good data, but if you don't have the good data, it's going to be really hard. The criminal justice data, it's not what people think. It's not as clear cut and dry as people think.
Yeah. So before I get to the data, actually, I want to go back to, I think, a point you kind of raised in passing, I think is important to mention to people. So you talk about these Innocence Project findings, and they're real and they're significant. But the catch is also is that by and large, they're limited to death penalty cases, some rape cases, but mostly death penalty, because those are the cases, A, where the person's been in prison long enough for these cases to work their way through the system. They also, the reason why it's murder and rape, is that the cases where most likely they have DNA evidence, which is what we use for exoneration. I'm not sure it's safe to extrapolate from capital cases to all of the crimes. In both directions, it's confusing, right? On the one hand, in capital cases, prosecutors face the most amount of pressure to get a conviction, right? These are front page news killings. This is, if this case gets botched, it's going to cost the current elected DA perhaps his job. If the assistant district attorney does a great job, this is his ticket to either better private practice or perhaps being the elected DA himself or a federal prosecutor position, right? And so the incentives to overwhelm things are greater there. On the other hand, capital cases are the cases where the defendant is most likely to have the highest quality lawyering he can get, right? And so the effects kind of offset, as opposed to a misdemeanor court where things kind of get ground through it in really complicated ways and the law is really unclear. On the one hand, how in misdemeanor court do you even know if you broke the law? One of the big misdemeanor charges like in New York State is disorderly conduct. And disorderly conduct in New York State is with the intent to cause a nuisance, you play music too loud. Like, how do you even know when you violate that? Like, how do you even know what's innocent or guilty in that situation? But I think the bigger point I want to stress is that my guess is that almost everyone in the system is actually legally guilty. And I'm using that phrase very carefully. Our criminal laws are incredibly broadly written, right? And you hear people talk a lot about sort of this over-criminalization problem. Right? There's this funny, Twitter feed called Crime A Day, which goes through the federal code, and every day tweets out one federal crime. Like, it's a federal crime if label pasta more than 5 millimeters thick as spaghetti, like that's a federal crime. And, you know, it's ridiculous, but no one's in prison for federal pasta labeling, right? It's the real challenge we have is that, you know, our assault laws are broadly written. Our public nuisance laws are broadly written. You know, our theft laws are broadly written. And so there are a lot, it's very easy to violate criminal conduct, even perhaps if punishment is not the right way to handle it, right? You know, when you punch someone in the head in a bar because you're frustrated and you're drunk and you just lose control and you punch them, you don't break their jaw, but you punch them. That's assault. Might even be aggravated assault. Might be assault with a deadly weapon, given what we've written deadly weapon if you hit them with your beer glass, right? Does every one of those cases really need to result in an arrest? Does it really need to result in a conviction? Is this really, does a criminal justice system have to police every sort of social ill that happens every time it happens? Right? That's our default response these days, right? As well, just punish them. And so I think as much as I admire what the work that the Innocence Project has done, I get concerned when it turns our framing around to like we have a huge innocence problem in our criminal justice system, because that implies that the people who are factually guilty kind of deserve to be punished. And I would stress that there's plenty of factually criminal behavior that doesn't necessarily deserve a record. Right? You know, when I was in high school, I punched a friend of mine in the head in a church. Right, so there's a different judging going on that one, but you know, did I deserve to like have a permanent criminal record from like two kids just throwing one punch at each other? I don't think either of us deserved that, and neither of us got that because there were no cops in our church, right? So the Innocence Project framing it does good work, but I think the real focus we have to have is that it's very easy to trip up and break the law. Do we always need to use the law just because you break it? Probably not. So I think that's one thing just keep in mind. Now to go back to the question you asked at the end, sort of what is the nature of our data? I mean, there's a couple of things realize about our criminal justice data. One is that it tends to be profoundly out of date, and that's just because we choose not to fund it. Right? You know, I watch with envy when labor economists each month wait for like last month's labor statistics to come out. Right? Meanwhile, my crime data for us comes out with a year lag. Prison data comes out with a 2-year lag, although some of us have a 3-year lag, to almost 2.5-year lag to them. Other data sets are good 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 years out of date. You know, the last year we have comparable spending data on prosecutors and public defender and sort of indigent defense offices is like 2005, right? It's almost 15 years old. And that's because we just don't pay for it, right? The Bureau of Labor Statistics has a budget that is more than 10 times the Bureau of Justice Statistics budget. And the BJS's budget, fully half of it goes to just running one data program, right? And so we've just chosen not to fund this. As a result, we don't really know what's going on, right? And so lots of our numbers that we rely on are incredibly stale. On top of that, reporting is voluntary, right? So not everyone always reports data. And I think, you know, how we define things is incredibly important, right? We talk about violent crime going up or violent crime going down, right? And or property crime going up or property crime going down. And I think, you know, if people don't really read the really, really small print, you might not kind of realize, like, what is violent crime? It's not all violence. It's just 4 violent crimes. Murder, manslaughter, aggravated assault, rape, the definition which has changed in recent years, and robbery. That's it. So, like, simple assault doesn't show up as an official crime number, right? And we track arrests for that, but not crimes, right? And you know, confusion can happen if we're not paying close attention to this, right? We make about 500,000 arrests for those serious violent crimes: murder, manslaughter, rape, aggravated assault, and robbery. We make about 1 million arrests for simple assault, the one we don't sort of track the offending levels for. And you hear people say things like, "We arrest more people for marijuana than for violent crimes." That's only true if you count those 4 major violent crimes. First, you make 500,000 arrests and about 500,000 marijuana arrests. If you count the 1 million simple assault arrests, we actually make more arrests for violent crime than for marijuana. Right? We might still make too many marijuana arrests, right? But we're still misframing the nature of discussion because the way we choose to define things is very, very ornery and particular.
Just remind folks, we're talking with Professor John Pfaff, PhD, JD, professor at Fordham College of Law. He's the author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. And thank you for the correction, because you're right. It's easy to fall into. I mean, the innocence and the my concern was about the first part you mentioned. I mean, a capital case, you would expect that they would try and get it right. And yet there is so much pressure, and the prosecutors, you know, these kinds of cases are career cases. And that leads me to the question of prosecutors. One thing in your book that you point out here in my home state of Oregon and around the country, a lot of nonprofits, a lot of advocacy groups are trying to raise awareness of, and that's the power of the prosecutor and the sort of influence they have. Could you speak about that for a moment?
Sure. So the prosecutor is probably, in many ways, one of the most powerful people in the system. He has tremendous discretion and almost no formal oversight, right? So, for example, if a prosecutor decides to drop charges, completely unreviewable, right? So the police make an arrest, prosecutor drops the charges, no one can appeal that, right? So whether or not your case goes forward entirely rests within that office. Also, our codes, our criminal codes are often very broad and overlapping. And so that gives, you know, prosecutors tremendous discretion about how to charge your conduct with huge implications, right? You know, attempted manslaughter, basically, you know, you sort of, you know, manslaughter is sort of accidentally, but in a really bad kind of way, cause of death. And so attempted manslaughter is when you engage in that kind of bad behavior, but death almost happens, but doesn't, right? That also could be, that's usually a very serious felony, right? But that same behavior, you know, accidentally almost cause of death, but don't, that could be a form of aggravated assault. That's a less serious punishment. Or you could even charge it, sometimes it could also be charged as sort of, you know, reckless endangerment, like engaging behavior that could cause death but doesn't. That's kind of attempted reckless homicide, but that's reckless endangerment. That might be a misdemeanor, right? Which means no prison time, just a jail time in the local county jail, up to a year and a fine, right? And as the prosecutor has pretty much unreviewable discretion to decide if they're going to charge you with attempted manslaughter, aggravated assault, or reckless endangerment, right? And so are you facing 10 years in prison, 4 years in prison, 6 months in jail? Right, that's entirely up to the prosecutor. And again, absent egregious behavior, pretty much completely unreviewable. And so that alone gives them huge power. They can choose how many different charges to charge you with, how to stack charges, whether they cut back on charges, whether they go forward their case at all or not. They can obviously, you know, threaten to, you know, charge other people if you don't settle with them, and again that's completely legal, and so they have all this power, and on top of that power we have no real oversight into what they do, right? In that they provide very little data. There's no centralized like federal effort to, like, we have, you know, for its all of its flaws, the feds really do try hard to gather data on crime and on prisons, and arrests. They don't really gather data on prosecutors, so we have really no, and they don't really provide detailed reports of their own. Generally, you've seen this starting to happen in places like Philadelphia and Chicago with progressive prosecutors, but generally they don't tell us anything about what they're doing. And so they have tremendous power, operating almost complete secrecy. They're directly elected in elections that tend to have very low turnout. So they don't really have a boss other than the electorate, and the electorate doesn't vote, because it's usually, in most cases, the prosecutor election is basically the primary, right? And those tend to be sort of a down ballot primary election, because they generally run sort of, you know, politically unopposed in the general. And so there's very little political oversight, very little sort of data oversight, you know, a tremendous amount of discretion. And in theory, all of this power would, in theory, kind of be checked by the jury, right? They can bring whatever charges they want, but there's sort of this body of, you know, the people there to protect them. And it's easy to oversell. Before we get to the absence of juries, the protectiveness of a jury, I remember when I was living in Chicago, there's an article in Chicago Reader pointing out that while, you know, around 90% of all criminal defendants in Cook County Court were black men, like 75% of the juries that were impaneled in jury trials were 100% white, right? And so it wasn't, you know, so you see a lot of, you know, young black men from the south and west side of Chicago, and they're being, you know, juries that were probably being pulled from sort of wealthier, more conservative, much whiter suburban Chicago, Cook County. But the real issue is the fact that most cases don't go to a jury, right? Of the cases, of the guilty verdicts that we get, about 90-some% come about through the plea bargain, where the defendant agrees to waive his right to the jury trial, waive his right to any trial at all. In exchange, he pleads guilty and, you know, in theory, gets something in exchange. You know, instead of charging you with 20 years, you plead guilty, we only give you 5 years. And they have, again, that gives them tremendous pressure to bring to bear, right? They can offer these incredibly sweet deals. You know, the Supreme Court case on what counts as coercive pressure is this famous case called Bordenkercher v. Hayes, in which I believe Hayes is the defendant here. I can never keep it straight. He wrote a bad check, but he was a repeat offender in Kentucky back in like the 40s or 50s, and they had a very harsh repeat offender law. And the DA told him, look, if you plead guilty, it's 3 years. If you don't plead guilty, I'm going to charge you as a repeat offender, and it's going to be life. And Hayes rolled the dice and lost, got convicted, got the life sentence with parole, but still a life sentence. And the Supreme Court said that was totally fine. Right, so they can make these incredibly coercive deals, right? Also, you know, they can use where you are as coercion, especially for misdemeanors. You know, do you have a defendant on who couldn't make bail, he's sitting on Rikers, and the DA can say, look, plead guilty to this, you go home today. And that's a huge incentive for someone to plead guilty to something they might even be guilty of, just to get out of a hellhole like Rikers, right? And all this, again, is subject to almost practically no review whatsoever. And as far as my data suggests, you know, what really drove prison growth in the 90s and 2000s when I had data on prosecutors really wasn't longer sentences. It wasn't growing arrests. Arrests actually fell during the 90s and 2000s as crime went down. What really changed, even as the number of arrests went down, the number of felony cases prosecutors chose to file went up. So they were choosing at an office level to be more aggressive. And that played a big role in causing prisons to keep growing steadily, even as crime went down over the 90s and 2000s.
Wow. Once again, a lot of people, prosecutor races, where I am now living, there is actually a contested prosecutor race. That's not exactly common, I guess.
I would say that 10 years ago, it was pretty much completely unheard of, that almost no DAs ran contested. If they did, they almost always won. Within the past, 2000, yeah, I'd say within the past like 8 or 9 years, you've started to see a much greater interest in these races, and you have seen pretty hard-fought races, lots of entrants, particularly at least in urban counties, right? I think the thing to realize, I think one of the things that really makes the thinking about prosecutors changes our conceptualization of criminal justice is that, you know, we often ask questions like, why is New York State different than Louisiana? Why is Tennessee different than Ohio? And from a criminal justice point of view, that's actually not the right way to think about it. One of the longest sustained decarcerations in the country has actually been New York. Unlike the rest of the country, we started declining in 1999. So we've got this almost 2-decade-long decline that we've been experiencing. And we've our prisons have shrunk by about 25,000 people since their peak, from about 75,000 to around 50,000. But what's fascinating is if you look at the period 99 to 2010, New York State as a whole did not decarcerate. If you look at the county in 1999 and ask how many people from your county were in prison in 1999 and how many people from your county were in prison in 2010. Of the 60-some counties in New York State, only 4 were sending fewer people to prison in 2010 than in 1999. It just happens to be that those 4 counties were Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens, and Manhattan, right? And so they drove the whole state down. But New York State didn't decarcerate. New York City decarcerated, and the rest of the state kind of got overwhelmed by our outsized importance. And so what we're seeing today, we sort of see this general decline, sort of this rough decline in state prison populations. It's uneven, and only about half the states have actually shrunk. But what's happening is that it's mostly urban counties that are shrinking and rural counties are getting harsher, right? So when we say like a given state has declined, oftentimes what you see when you look at a map is it's less that the state has declined, it's that the urban counties have shrunk faster than the rural counties have grown. And so what we have seen in prosecutor elections, at least, is a rise in sort of these progressive-minded prosecutors, but mostly in urban counties. And the politics of that is very much framed around urban issues of, you know, sort of racial justice and sort of the racism and then classism baked into the criminal justice system, which is what resonates in, say, Baltimore or Chicago or Boston or St. Louis, or the other Brooklyn, to a lesser extent Queens, these cities where we've seen these progressive or quasi-progressive victories. You know, I think there is a way to talk about progressive prosecution in rural America, but it's going to be framed in a radically different way that doesn't speak to issues of sort of racism, because these counties tend not to be very racially diverse, but perhaps more to sort of the anxieties of you know, poor working class white America, which tends to make up these increasingly punitive counties. And so, you know, 10 years ago, there's really nothing. The trend we've seen lately is this rise, sort of this progressive DA movement in urban counties. In urban counties tend to have most of the people, so that's a good place to start. But it's not spreading to rural America. They're actually getting harsher and harsher. And I think there's a growing effort to figure out how do you translate sort of less punitive arguments in a way that resonates with more rural, more racially homogenous, more conservative rural America. And I think there's definitely a way to do that. We just haven't done a lot of it yet.
And that's it for this week. That was part one of my interview with Professor John Pfaff. He's a professor of law at Fordham Law School. Dr. Pfaff is also the author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. Part two is going to be great, and we will have that next week. For now, that's it. I want to thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. The executive producer of the Drug Truth Network is Dean Becker.
One of the reasons I love the West Coast is people here ask me if I want marijuana rather than if I have marijuana. You understand? Right? Everywhere else I go, people are like, man, you got any weed? Man, I don't know you. Yeah, all right, come on.
You want a brownie?
I don't want a brownie right now because I'm talking to people. Once I no longer have to talk to people, I will eat all of your brownies. And then I'll have crazy hashish-laced dreams. What were we talking about? Weed? For me, weed is the umami flavor of life. You understand? Right? Weed is the soy sauce. Weed is the ketchup. Weed is the ranch dressing of doing right? So it's cool. You put some weed on it, it's a little bit cooler. Right? Maybe it's not cool at all. Dip it in some weed, it's all right. Right? I don't care to wash dishes, but I don't mind getting high and washing dishes. Right? It's actually very pleasant. It takes an extra hour because I have to make a plate. Thank you, Ed. Let's hear it for New Jersey Weed Man, by the way. Who says people in New Jersey are rude? That was very polite. He brought me a joint and a lighter. Now he's going to smoke it for me, right? I will pass to the left. Mm, that's delicious. Is that a...
Terpenes.
The terpenes. It's got some purpleine and some sizzling in there. Right? I can taste the Listerine. This is going to make your breath great. It has great effects on breath. Oh, look at all these older people. We're all getting old, right? Some of us been here. Here's the thing, though. Here's the thing. This is what I noticed. Weed keeps you cute. Old stoners are way cuter than old drunks. Right? You know what I'm talking about? That's what I'm saying. Everyone's like, oh, cute. Grandpa's hitting the bong again. Right? As opposed to grandpa's hitting your mom again. That's a completely different... That's why I like weed. See if I can figure out where it's from with my connoisseur palate. You guys don't do connoisseur. You don't sit around with your fancy pants, give some tasting notes.
Drug Truth Network programs are available by podcast. The URL to subscribe is on the network homepage at drugtruth.net. Drug Truth Network has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. Drug War Facts is on Facebook too. Give it a like. Share it with friends. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.